Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. Just before 2 o'clock on the afternoon of the 30th of January 1649, Charles Stuart, King of England, Scotland and Ireland, walked out onto a platform erected outside the Banqueting House in Whitehall in London. He read a short speech to his attendants, he knelt and placed his head on the block, and a moment later, the axe came down and he was dead. It was one of the most extraordinary moments in British and indeed in European history, the public trial and execution of an anointed monarch for crimes against the rights and liberties of the people. And almost 400 years on, it still arouses remarkably strong feelings. So Tom Holland, are you a devotee of Charles King and Martyr? Or do you think the man of blood got what he deserved?
I'm very much with Thomas Fairfax, Lord Fairfax, who commanded the army, in that I'm a massive fence sitter.
You're a liberal democrat on this.
Well, basically, I think Charles was a terrible king. He was obdurate. He refused to negotiate. He pushed England into a second bout of civil war. I think he had blood on his hands. At the same time, I don't think that beheading him solved anything. And I think it was actually in the long run a victory for Charles, for the monarchy, and particularly for Charles's vision of the monarchy. So I think it's an absolute mess. And I don't think it's a kind of, you know, was he a goodie or baddie, you know, whose side would he be on kind of situation. It's just, and speaking as someone who's living in a country that's seems to have gone through quite a lot of imponderable political messes recently, you just look back at that and think, well, I'm glad I wasn't alive then and I didn't have to have an opinion.
Very evasive answer, but it doesn't really matter what you think because we've got a genuine expert. So,
well, hold on, Dominic. Before we introduce the genuine expert, let's go to you.
Yeah.
What do you think?
People who listen to our recent podcast will know that I took a very stern and robust line on The Princess and the Tower, thinking that Richard III did it, but he was right to do it. So on this, I would say I feel sorry for Charles I. I think his trial and execution was his finest hour, but I think they were probably right to get rid of him.
Okay. Yeah.
You know I'm a big Cromwellian, Tom. So
I do. Yes, I do. I do. So you're more Cromwell than Fairfax on this.
Sort of, I'm cruel necessity. You know, I'm wiping away a manly tear, but at the same time, I'm saying he's got to go.
Yeah. So that's the story, isn't it? That Cromwell gazed at the corpse of Charles I,
which I'm sure our guest will tell us is totally invented.
So our guest, the great Ted Valance, who came on last year to talk about Magna Carta, and now is back. And Ted, this is very, very much your field at the moment, isn't it? Because you're actually writing a book about it.
So I'm working on the trial at the moment. Yeah.
So there's only really one question, isn't there? It's after Magna Carta's the podcast. Ted, do you know Charles I's dates?
I know the end date very much, Dominic, because you just said it. So yeah, 1600 to 1649, and of course, famously, you know, shorter at the end of his reign than.
Very good.
All of which badinage suggests, Ted, that you as well are maybe more on the Cromwellian.
I think opinion yes. on this. Well, more seriously, I think that, you know, there is. I was very interested when I was sort of poking the bear a bit by asking your listeners, you know, what questions that they would like to ask about the trial of Charles I. And one person responded, "What circle of hell do the regicides currently reside in?"
Would this have been a Mr. Cappel Loft?
It wasn't, in fact. although it was another one of your listeners, and it is remarkable, really, given this is an event that happened in 1649. There clearly is some, you know, that level of strong feeling still about it. But I think it's a case of, you know, as Thomas Paine said, pitying the plumage and not the bird. This is a man who was responsible for the deaths of, you know, tens of thousands of his subjects.
Well, was he?
He fitted in many respects, you know, the classical definition of a tyrant. Those charges of being a tyrant, a murderer, you know, a public enemy, these are all charges that could be substantiated. So he got what he deserved, really.
Oh, Ted, strong views. Okay,
so robust stuff. But we should, you know, from the point of balance, point out that absolutely. So this is going out the week where his death is commemorated
Yes.
At church yes. services. I, yes. At, you know, he wasn't he's commemorated a martyr as a saint and martyr.
He wasn't a martyr well. Either. Milton okay, was I'm, absolutely right about that. He's a faux just, martyr too. Let's really wind your listeners up, including members of the society for, you know.
Okay, well, I think we're not the BBC, so we can be as biased as we like. But just for the sake of balance, we should point out that we certainly do have listeners, Capel Loft preeminent among them, who are very, very passionate about this. And Dominic Capel Loft berated us, didn't he, for not including Charles I in the list of...
The World Cup of Kings.
The World Cup of Kings. So there is a broad range of opinion. And Ted, I mean, that I guess when we're talking about a civil war, that's unsurprising. So could you, for people who aren't British or people who are British who don't know very much about it, just very quickly, what was the English Civil War?
What's going on
about the War of the Three Kings? I mean, it's so complex; we don't even know what to call it.
Yeah,
let's call it the English Civil War for the sake of argument. With apologies to Scottish and Irish listeners.
Yeah, if we try and focus on England, just to sort of keep it as simple as possible. I mean, that there are so it is a very complicated series of events and so many things behind it and leaning into it. But let's try and focus on a few of them. One is religion. And this is sort of, you know, the aftershocks and after effects of the English Reformation. Charles I's religious policies deeply anger and cause a great deal of fear amongst English Puritans. They see the king and his bishops as trying to reintroduce Catholicism, popery, as they call it. So the changes that the king makes in terms of when his bishops make in terms of the fabric of English churches, the reintroduction of more of a kind of sort of ceremonial and sort of the beauty of holiness, as Charles's Archbishop William Lord calls it, into English churches, all cause a great deal of fear that the king is basically trying to reintroduce Catholicism. And that is exacerbated by the fact that leading Puritans are persecuted by the king, prosecuted for publishing anti-Episcopal tracts. So William Prynne famously has his ears cropped twice as a result of publishing hostile works against the king. Well, they trimmed them the first time, and the second time they kind of cut off the stumps. So particularly galling for William Prynne, who was an opponent of long hair as well. He then had to grow his hair to sort of cover up the holes that were left there. So
the cruelest cut of all.
Yeah, you know, there's. So religious controversy is at the heart of it.
And Ted, Charles's wife, Henrietta Maria, is Catholic.
She's Catholic, and so there's a great deal of fear about that, and of foreign influence as well. And you know that there's basis to that, as we see in the Civil War, in that Henrietta Maria is basically Charles I's chief advisor. After the death of Duke of Buckingham, she becomes the most important person at court. But there are also political constitutional issues at play here as well, because Charles has so much difficulty with his parliament that basically he rules without parliament from 1629 up until 1640. So his period of personal rule, or the 11 years tyranny, as his critics call it. And these are issues, the issues that he has with his parliament around, his foreign policy. They are around, the way in which the king is raising money and what he does with those who refuse to pay the money that he wants, his use of sort of basically imprisonment without trial, and the way that he is dealing with his critics. So there are already people as well who are seeing the king not just as somebody who may be trying to reintroduce Catholicism, but somebody who is ruling in a tyrannical fashion.
And Ted, the general sense of the war of the king against the parliament, the monarchy is much older than the parliament, but there is a sense, isn't there, in which actually it's Charles who is the radical.
Yeah, isn't he a modernizer in a sense, like trying to bring in a kind of absolutism? Is that right, Ted?
Yeah, well, the language that's used a lot by his critics is of innovation. And they are very much casting, you know, the Puritans and those who are kind of opponents of Charles I's fiscal policies are very much presenting themselves as the defenders of the status quo, with the king, his ministers, and the church as the innovators, as those who are trying to transform the state and the church.
And is that also the Norman yoke and the idea of ancestral English freedoms? That's kind of bubbling away as well.
I mean, that certainly comes into play as well, that the king is challenging that those rights that are gifted through that ancient constitution. And yes, there is an anxiety too that is linked to things like, you know, the queen and her influence, that the king is trying to move England towards a European absolutist Catholic state. And sort of warning signs as well come through court culture too. So Charles is a great collector of art. He spends a lot of money on his court entertainments, these court masks. But a lot of this court aesthetic is the aesthetic of the European absolutist court. The artworks are artworks that resonate with that kind of political system and also with a more Catholic church as well.
Just at the end, so at the end of that period that you talk about, the 11 years personal rule, so before Charles gets into a mess with the Scots and then has to recall parliaments, and then you're on the sort of slippery slides of the Civil War. So before that, just before that, in the sort of late 1630s, is there a sense of sort of pressure building and people thinking that this is a tyrannical regime? I mean, the sort of broad mass of the public, or the broad mass of the public kind of quiescent and just kind of plodding along?
Well, it's a weird combination of the two. So you've got sort of, there's no kind of active rebellion and so on. So in one sense, it looks very peaceful. And it then looks like it's sort of, you know, a dramatic sort of unexpected kind of collapse of this regime, certainly in England. Obviously, things are already going wrong in Scotland, as you mentioned. But when we look at what people are saying, so yes, you've got, as it were, the kind of machinery of government going on and local government continuing, and these taxes that are deeply unpopular, like ship money, being administered and collected. But when you look at what...
And they're unpopular because they're being levied inland.
They're being levied, yeah. So this particular tax is unpopular because traditionally it would have been imposed on maritime counties and only imposed during periods of emergency. So when there's an invasion threat, for example.
Vikings.
Yeah. Yeah. Vikings, absolutely. So that tax is being collected, by people like Oliver Cromwell. But when we see what some of those people are saying about having to collect this tax, it is that this is deeply worrying that they're having to do this, that it is a sign that this is a government which is, you know, operating in a tyrannical fashion.
And Ted, I mean, now that there's a lot of kind of, whenever a government does any measure, people say, oh, this is becoming like Hitler.
They'd be astounded if they were saying it then.
Is there a kind of 17th century equivalent
where the government
does anything and people say, oh, this is like popery. This is, you know, we're all going to be the Inquisition.
You'll be pleased to know, Tom, that the comparisons are Roman. So this is like Nero. Nero.
We've been guilty of that as well.
Ted, there are obviously lots of points in English history where people are disaffected and cross with, as it were, the government. But often what they do is they say, you know, the king has ill counsel or something like that. So in other words, they don't say immediately jump to saying the king is a dreadful tyrant and the most awful person. Is it personalized in that way already in the 1630s? People pointing specifically at Charles?
Well, actually, Dominic, there's a question from Dave Walters, because actually it's about Charles's character, right? So Dave Walters asks, wasn't major conflict with Parliament inevitable when Charles became king, given his character? And would almost any other monarch of the era have succeeded in keeping more of the people that mattered on side?
Yeah, I think Charles's character does play a big role in this. So there is a distinct difference between how James, his father, operates and how Charles operates. So James is much better at you know, allowing debate and accepting that there will be criticism, that there will be, you know, arguments about policies and so on. Charles has a tendency to see criticism and argument as itself a problem. So actually, if we look at his court culture, whereas what James liked was disputations where he could show off how intellectual he was, what Charles likes is these kinds of performances, these masks where royalty appears and solves everything. You know, it's like the fantastic painting of him as some people may have seen, you know the painting of him as St. George besting the dragon. And basically it's the monarch has solved everything. All disputes, all, you know, disagreements have been pushed aside. And so he can't accept it when there is opposition, when there is disputation about policies. It's not something that he recognises as sort of just part of political life.
But in the grand scheme of kind of bad monarchical behaviour, I mean, you last time you came on, we were talking about King John, who I think we all agreed is an absolutely terrible man. And you mentioned Nero.
Yeah.
I mean, Charles I's defenders would presumably say he's a nice family man. You know, he likes paintings. He's not cruel. He's, you know, is tyrant the right word?
So I think, you know, in comparison to figures like Nero and King John, yes, absolutely. He looks much, much better. But I think to come back to the question you were asking just before Tom rudely interrupted.
Yeah, that was rude.
What is difficult about the evil counsellor's position, which is certainly one that gets used, and certainly in the early years of the Civil War, that they're not fighting the king. They're trying to actually kind of rescue the king from the clutch of these evil counsellors who are leading him astray. Is that Charles is very obviously, with Henrietta Maria, kind of in control of things. And for one thing, his main favourite prior to Henrietta Maria, the Duke of Buckingham, has been bumped off. And there's no other figure who really replaces him. I mean, Strafford, his Lord Deputy in Ireland, to a certain extent. But it's really the King and the Queen who seem to be kind of running the show and dictating things. So it's quite hard to sort of say, oh, well somebody else is actually, you know, driving this and to blame. It's a bit, it already feels a bit artificial from that point of view. And then when you look at this criticism that's going on in the 1630s, you have, you know, you already have got people like Prynne who are saying, albeit in a kind of, you know, allegorical and trying to sort of, you know, not immediately direct way, they're already making these connections between Charles and classical tyrants. They're not sort of saying, oh, it's somebody else. It is already, you know, Charles who is the problem that is being identified.
Yeah. And the second part of Dave Walter's question, would almost any other monarch of the era have succeeded in keeping more of the people that mattered on side? I mean, could
that
you
one,
imagine?
I think that one is harsher on Charles. There are big problems that, you know, the monarch is facing, any monarch would be facing, and those are inheritances from his father, and also, you know, from the Tudor era as well. There is the unfinished business of the English Reformation. You know, we've got this issue of a church that is half reformed, with significant sections that want it to become much more Protestant, and others who don't want it to move that far towards a more Calvinist style of church. You've also got the problem created by the union of crowns of governing multiple kingdoms, and kingdoms with very different religious establishments as well.
But
you've got the problem of the fact that the, you know, the financial stability of the monarchy has been an issue through the reigns of Elizabeth and through the reigns of James as well. But so it is not an easy inheritance.
Couldn't the counter be that, as you say, he inherits a lot of these problems from Elizabeth and James, but both of them were unpopular at times, but they managed to they were more skillful. And also his son, Charles II, faces not dissimilar problems and also is not executed. So Charles is doing something wrong.
Yes, he is. The question as to, you know, yes, he has, you know, inherits a lot of issues, but it is Charles and his character and his decision making, which plays a large part in bringing things to this extraordinary conclusion in 1649.
Right. Okay. Which we have to get to.
Yes.
Let's just speed through. So everything, the state of crisis that you've brilliantly set out leads in the long run to civil war, and war rages between Parliament and King, and it ends with the King's defeat. And that looks to be conclusive. But we then have a question from Stephen Clark, friend of the show. After heavy defeat by the New Model Army at Naseby, so the New Model Army is, it's new. It's a model army. It's New Model Army.
Brilliant punditry, Tom.
top 17th century analysis there. And it's particularly associated with Cromwell. After heavy defeat by the New Model Army at Naseby in June 1645 in the First English Civil War, why did Charles I risk a second civil war against them in 1648?
Well, that's key to this story, isn't it? He's seen as triggering.
So what's going on with the second civil war?
So, well, I think this is, again, comes back to Charles's character, is that he's always trying to play his opponents off each other rather than negotiating good faith. And he's always looking for a way to recover, to go back to, the status quo before the Civil War. He doesn't really want to concede anything in terms of his authority. And so the engagement, as it's called, that he makes with the Scottish Covenanters is a way for him to do that, to basically get out of.
So tell us who the Scottish Covenanters are.
So the Covenanters are the people who have been opponents of Charles I in the 1630s and opposed to his religious policies in Scotland. And they form this national covenant, against those policies. But they are also monarchists, and so they're also opposed to the establishment of a republic, and they form this alliance, although it's one that actually splits the Covenanter cause and which leads to the Second Civil War.
So basically, am I right in thinking, Ted, that after Charles, so Charles was cornered at the end of the First Civil War, and he was captured. He went over to the Scots, didn't he? And
yes,
they sold him to Parliament. But there's a point at which there are basically, I'm not massively clear on all the different factions, but there's the Scots, there's some people in Parliament who want to do a deal with Charles, and then there's the army who are supposedly answerable to Parliament, but have now got their own agenda. Is that basically
the armed
right
wing of the English people?
Yeah, that's basically it. So the situation sort of post First Civil War is that the king is a prisoner, but he's a prisoner of different factions at different points. So he starts off as a prisoner of the Covenanters, as you say, then becomes Parliament's prisoner, then in a rather dramatic and extraordinary instance, he's seized by a very lowly officer, Cornet Joyce, for the army, and taken into the army's custody. The king asks Cornet Joyce what his authority is, and Joyce points at the other soldiers behind him. And you can read that in two ways. He's either saying, shut up, I've got some guys with muskets with me, or the army is my authority.
Yeah.
We have the authority ourselves. So, yes, there are these three different parties. And actually also the growing distrust between the army and Parliament is critical here, because what a lot of the rank and file in the army fear is that both Parliament and also the army leadership are going to sell them out with a soft peace. They are basically going to conclude a peace with the king, which will mean that they're not protected from being prosecuted for what they've done in the Civil War. And that is something that they are very worried about, that, you know, that they'll basically do a deal with Charles I, and then Charles I will go back on that and they'll, you know, be strung up.
So Charles, when does he get taken to Carisbrooke Castle on the Isle of Wight?
So what happens is actually that Charles escapes from Hampton Court And the reason why he is driven to escape is important as well, because during the Putney debates, which are mostly famous for this discussion over the right to vote.
So this is the new model army
and civilian levellers discussing the agreements of the people, these in the case of the army, these radical documents, talking about, you know, every man having the right to vote, the poorest he is, has as much a life to live as the greatest he, as Thomas Rainsborough says. But what also gets discussed at Putney is what to do with the king. And a couple of officers, one of whom Thomas Harrison goes on to become a regicide himself, called Charles I. Yeah, friend of the show, Thomas Harrison.
He's the one who we mentioned in the
dies very cheerfully. Yes.
So he's a fifth monarchist man.
Fifth monarchist. He calls Charles I a man of blood and says that the king must be proceeded against as a man of blood. So there is already talk late 1647 in the army about putting the king on trial. And Charles hears about this via John Lilburne, who is a prisoner in the Tower at this point in time, but a prisoner with royalist prisoners. And word reaches Charles I at Hampton Court about these kinds of statements that are being made about his fate, and decides it's time to do a runner, basically, and not, leave himself.
But at that point, Ted, that must be is that not perceived why generally as a very extreme and radical position to try and execute the king? Because the Second Civil War hasn't happened, so Charles hasn't completely sort of, as it were, disgraced himself further yet. So do most people in the army and in Parliament think, well, that's bonkers, we're obviously not going to try him? Or are there quite a lot of people who say, no, that's right, he's got to go?
So in terms of the army leadership, you're right. And Cromwell is actually argues against Harrison. He says, and they basically have an argument over the biblical interpretation. So this phrase, man of blood, is rooted in the Old Testament. It's rooted in Book of Genesis and Book of Numbers. You know, it's the idea that basically he who spills blood, the guilt of that blood must be assuaged by the shedding of the murderer's blood in order to assuage God's wrath. But what Cromwell says in answer to Harrison is, no, there's different ways of interpreting that text. And actually, it's a text that can be about moral admonition rather than, you know, putting people to death. So certainly the army leadership at this point in time is trying to argue against that view. But you can see, even, in the immediate aftermath of the First Civil War, growing anger amongst the rank and file. There are members of the rank and file who reportedly refer to Charles as Ahab as well, making Henrietta Maria his Jezebel too. So there's already, in the wake of the First Civil War, that level of anger against him, and a way of seeing him as this sort of wicked king who must be done away with.
So it's actually incredibly foolish of Charles to then take the decisions like running away, plotting, behaving badly.
So, yeah, again, it's a bad decision to go to the Isle of Wight. He decides to flee to the Isle of Wight because he thinks that the governor there, Robert Hammond, is sympathetic to him and will help him escape to the continent. But in fact, he doesn't do that and locks him up there.
Carisbrook Castle.
Carisbrook Castle. He makes a couple of attempts to escape from Carisbrook Castle.
Yeah, the window that he's trying to get through is still there.
Yes, which are comically unsuccessful. He gets stuck in the window. Yeah. And the second attempt, he's trying to, he's got nitric acid and a hacksaw, and he tries to sort of trying to cut open the bars and gets caught halfway, in mid sort of hack.
But to be fair to Charles, I mean, he's got no prior experience of escape.
No,
attempts,
he's
right?
not. That's fair.
I mean, he's just been sitting around watching masks in the
not an experienced jailbreaker.
He's not a kind of Houdini figure.
Not a Jack Shepherd of the 17th century.
So he's in Carisbrook Castle failing to escape. And meanwhile, what is happening with the return of England to civil war?
So, yes, so he's in Carisbrook. He's entered into this engagement. As soon as the news of the engagement reaches Parliament, which has been, trying to negotiate with the king, it breaks off these negotiations.
So the engagement, sorry, is with the Scots.
Is with the Scottish Covenanters. and issues a very remarkable declaration that it will have no further addresses from the king, there'll be no further personal treaty for the king, in which declaration it accuses Charles of all sorts of terrible crimes, including covering up the murder of his father, James I, by the Duke of Buckingham through the use of poisons. So it entertains the most extraordinary conspiracy theories about the king. So that seems to sort of, you know, make things look even worse for Charles I, that Parliament is making these kinds of statements. The Second Civil War itself goes very badly for the Royalists and the Covenanters. So there are risings in Wales, there are risings in Kent, they're the most serious ones. There's a Covenanter invasion. The Covenanters are crushed at the Battle of Preston by Cromwell's forces. It's also Cromwell who suppresses the rebellion in Wales. Fairfax suppresses the rebellion in Kent. There's a really nasty siege in Colchester, which Fairfax is also in command of. Finally, they surrender at the end of August 1648, and two of the Royalist commanders are summarily executed, which is again a sign of how things have hardened, attitudes have hardened during the course of this conflict. So the Royalists are defeated. And I think the Second Civil War is really pivotal in this, because it does something really important, which is it changes the attitude of the army command. So whereas I said in Putney, we've got Cromwell arguing against, prosecuting the king. I think by the end of the Second Civil War, he has become convinced that Charles has to be prosecuted. He says that, you know, Charles is a man against whom the Lord has witnessed, you know, God has made his judgment against the king, and now it is time that the king is dealt with.
Just before we carry on, I think it's time for a quick break. In the name of God, go. Hello, welcome back to part two of today's episode of The Rest is History. We are discussing Charles I, his trial, his execution, with Professor Ted Valance. The Royalists have been now conclusively and decisively and publicly defeated in the eyes of God. That's how everyone on the parliamentarian side sees it. But the problem remains that the king is not the kind of man to accept compromise.
Yes.
So I guess that there are various options. One, you try and persuade the king to accept the kind of compromises that you as a parliamentarian want. That presumably doesn't work well, because Charles is digging his heels in. He feels that God wants him to defend bishops and all that kind of stuff. So there's no real prospect of negotiation there. The other option, one that has happened throughout English history, is that where you have a problematic king, whether it's Richard II or Henry VI or whatever, you dispose of him and you come up with a new king. Is there no thought of doing that?
Yeah, there certainly is thought of doing that. So the most likely candidate for that option that you're talking about is Charles's youngest son, Henry. And Henry is in Parliament's custody.
And
at
he's
this
eight,
point,
isn't he?
Yeah. So the thinking is that he could be, he's young enough that he could be sort of trained up to be a sort of parliamentarian puppet king, you know, with very limited power, if any power. But that is certainly one option that seems to be being entertained, and actually is possibly still being entertained after the king is executed, because, you know, Henry remains in Parliament's custody after the execution, and
he does actually become a kind of very hot Protestant, doesn't he?
He
ends up with his mother, and they can't get on at all. So why do they not go with him?
I think ultimately I think there's a few things here. One, obviously, we move as we go through the 1650s into a situation where effectively it becomes a kind of Cromwellian dynasty instead, and so that, you know, we're moving away from that. I think the other thing is that there is a sense in which this becomes about more than doing away with a wicked king.
Yeah. And okay. So that's the third option, isn't it? You decide that it's not just the king that's been judged, but the whole institution of monarchy.
It is monarchy that is the problem. It is the monarchy fundamentally leads to this sort of corrupt, oppressive form of government.
But that is a very, very, very radical position. I mean, it's not a position. I mean, I don't know how many people held that position at the start of the Civil War in the early 1640s, but not many, I would have thought.
And it remains.
How radical a position is it in the summer of 1648 as the commanders of the army are trying to work out what to do? How radical a position is that in the context of England as a whole?
Yes, it remains a very radical position. It remains a very radical position. And I think it's even more radical because at this point in time, it is increasingly, we're not talking about the kind of aristocratic republicanism that, could be seen
Venice
in things, a Venetian form of republicanism. It is a republicanism that is being grounded in ideas of popular sovereignty. There's a kind of leveler-infused republicanism. And so there's a great deal of anxiety about that. I mean, just as an example of this, the royalist diarist John Evelyn sneaks into the Whitehall debates of December 1648, which is the army sitting again with civilian levellers discussing, what to do, how to settle the kingdom. And he talks about the horrid villainies that are discussed at the Whitehall debates. So he's shocked by the matter of what is being discussed. But the thing that also really shocks him is what he describes as the raw, ill-mannered young men who are speaking there. So what Evelyn is also is scandalized by is momentum is by the fact that these are young men, young lower class men who are speaking to their social betters as if there were no distinctions of class between them, who are speaking as if there's nothing that should stop them from taking control.
And is that what makes this different from, say, if a similar event had happened 100 years previously? I mean, you had, the Pilgrimage of Grace or something, where there's a kind of real culture of kind of deference still to Henry VIII, even though people are outraged by his religious policy. Is that something that has changed by the, partly because of, is it because of literacy and prints and all these kinds of things?
Yeah, I think so, because, and I think that is something where, the Civil War itself, because of the things that you're talking about in terms of the explosion of sort of printed news reporting, this sort of greater literacy to kind of absorb that material, this is something where there has been a kind of real radicalizing effect on the population, particularly on soldiers within the new model army over the course of the 1640s.
Right. So Ted, could we now go into the process by which Charles is brought to trial and then ultimately to the block. So while Cromwell is away, the army are basically kind of self-radicalizing perhaps. And they come up with something called the Remonstrance of General Fairfax and the Council of Officers. Just tell us what that is, because that's very important, isn't it?
It is. So it's largely drafted by Henry Ireton. Cromwell's son-in-law, also a significant leader of the new model army, but with input from some of these civilian levellers as well. And it is a lengthy kind of indictment of Charles, and it demands that, effectively, it demands that the king should be brought to justice. Now, this is a very long document as well. It's about 25,000 words. It's read in full to Parliament, so it takes several hours to do that.
Fun.
As you can manage, a few MPs probably nodding off during the during the reading.
Although I suppose it's so explosive in its implications that perhaps.
I think probably attention was there wasn't any problem with that during the reading, and it is met with great consternation by Parliament. It becomes very clear that Parliament is not going to accept that call to bring the king to justice. And so that then moves the army to another solution, which is basically to purge Parliament of those members who are not going to support bringing the king to trial in what's known as Pride's Purge, after the commander Thomas Pride, who with his guard of troops prevents these MPs who've been identified as moderates from entering the chamber. Some of them are just dismissed and some of them are put into custody.
So this is basically a coup. I mean, that's what it is.
Yes, and it is also something I think we should emphasise that had actually been talked about in the army as well before. So it is not the army, figures in the army have been talking about purging Parliament for some time, because as I said, Parliament had become seen as being increasingly suspect as well.
How do they justify that, Ted? Because they can't claim there's any constitutional basis. Do they claim, is there a kind of religious justification for it, that they're doing God's work or something?
No, I think that the justification is primarily political, and it is that these MPs are of suspect loyalty, that these MPs are people who are, you know, disaffected, who are quasi-royalist.
So would it be fair to say that, I mean, the trial of Charles I, that in a way, it's not really about his crimes, whether he's guilty of crimes, even whether he should be put to death, but it's about who has political legitimacy, what the source of political legitimacy is, and that's essentially what's at stake. And anyone who stands in the way of the army declaring that they have the political legitimacy basically have to be purged, whether it's the monarchy or whether it's traditionalist parliamentarians.
Yeah, and that's made very clear in a declaration of the Commons on January the 4th, where they basically say, you know, we are the sovereign power as representatives of the people. Not the king, not the lords. Now, there's an expedient reason for this, which is that the lords, you know, despite all of this purging, the lords still refuse to pass the legislation to create this new court that is going to try the king. And so the Commons respond with this declaration where they say, well, we're supreme anyway, so it doesn't matter. But it's also, I think, something that is coming out of all of these years of discussion. All these leveller ideas, the kind of radical ideas that are coming out of the army rank and file, that actually it's the people who are supreme.
So on the 4th of January, they say the people are, under God, the original of all just power, that the Commons of England in Parliament assembled, being chosen by and representing the people, have the supreme power in this nation. And that's the kind of the key, isn't it? The justification. And the army is casting itself as what? The kind of the armed wing?
Yeah.
Of the British people.
And, you know, in practical terms, they do have, you know, much greater claim to be representative than the House of Commons does, even, or, you know, or certainly because, the House of Lords. So, yes. Yeah.
And on the, there's this prophetess from Abingdon, Elizabeth Poole.
Yes.
Who's, I mean, she's, you know, kind of humble background, who nevertheless declares to be speaking the truths of God, and she's brought up, isn't she, and kind of very seriously consulted, and so she's that's a kind of I mean, what's going on there? Because that seems quite, is that expressive of an anxiety that maybe God's will does need to be scoped?
Yes. Totally. So I think they're willing to give this woman an audience because they are desperately keen to understand what God's providence,
it's a kind of theological focus group.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And she says, bring him to trial, but don't kill him. Basically.
Yeah.
So at that point, right, Ted, Parliament's been purged. The army leadership have been radicalized. They've all decided on the trial. At that point, when they're talking about a trial, is there even the slightest doubt in their mind that he will be found guilty? I mean, is it basically a show trial from the beginning, or do they genuinely think, well, maybe he'd be acquitted? Who knows?
Yeah, so obviously this has been a major kind of source of debate among historians. And my feeling is that there isn't really any, I don't think there's any doubt that Charles is going to be found guilty, personally. It's interesting to look at the trials that happen in February of 1649. So after Charles is tried, basically other royalist commanders are put on trial before the same body, the High Court of Justice. And unlike Charles, all of those defendants actually recognise the court and enter pleas. They all plead that they're not guilty. They're all found guilty.
So, right.
You know.
Yeah, they're wasting their time.
And what is their fate?
Well, this is interesting, and this is where perhaps I think there is more wriggle room. Three of them are executed, but two of them are let off. And what happens basically is they're all condemned by the court, but their sort of punishment is then reverted to Parliament for ultimate decision making. And Parliament basically votes that three of them are going to die, and two of them, the votes turn in their favour, one of them by just one vote, by the Speaker's vote.
Wow.
Who's an old mate. Who's an old mate of the...
Ted, the key thing that you said there was that Charles I does not recognise the court.
Yes.
And that essentially is the key. Because if he does recognise the legitimacy of the court, then he is destroying the ideological basis for the kind of monarchy that he's always upheld. I mean, is that basically the issue for him?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, he's got very good grounds. His position is a very strong one in terms of the strategy that he uses. I should also say it's a strategy that is anticipated as well. So there's a royalist newsletter writer, Marchmont Nedham, who predicts in his manuscript newsletters that what's going to happen is the king is not going to recognise the court, he won't plead, and he'll be found guilty pro confesso, as if he had confessed. But what will happen is that the king is not going to be executed. Instead, the kind of sword will be kind of hanging over his head. And this will be used as a way of getting the king to to the negotiating table to agree to all the things that
the king doesn't want him to
do. But the king won't do that. Yes. Yeah.
So he is a martyr to that degree.
And is Charles, Ted, is at this point, so the winter of 1648, 1649, they're setting up the court. Does he have, I mean, this might sound a stupid question, does he have legal advice? I mean, is he meeting with people who are telling him...
his barrister.
Discussing his strategy kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I think the short answer, I think, not really, because by this point, he's a very close prisoner. So, you know, they have finally learnt the lessons of, you know, 1646 through to late 1648. Well, the king's been trying to escape multiple times and had various people passing intelligence to him. So by this point, he's a very close prisoner.
And he's still guarded by Thomas Harrison, isn't he?
Yeah, so we don't have the same situation as we get with actually what happens in the trials in February 49, where in fact we know that John Lilburne was helping to advise those royalist prisoners on their defence. And they're actually allowed defence counsel because they recognise the courts. They're actually allowed some very high status lawyers. Matthew Hale works on behalf of those royalist prisoners. Doesn't do them any good at the end of the day, but you know they have a lot of good legal advice. This is something that, yeah, I think, you know, we have to give a lot of credit to the king himself in terms of how he constructs his defence.
So it is an impressive defence. So the king has been brought over from Carisbrooke to a castle on the Solent, and then he's brought up by Major Harrison to Windsor. Is that right?
Yes.
And he's under close guard. Is there I'm sure we'll talk about Louis XVI and the French Revolution towards the end of this, but is there a kind of an attempt to remind him of how far he's fallen? Is there a kind of republican tinge to his treatment? Is he still treated as God's anointed by the people who are guarding him?
He is treated with respect, but there's a definite kind of trimming down of the amount of kind of, well, the number of people who can attend him, the ceremonial is much reduced. So there is a definite kind of diminution of all of the sort of trappings of royalty by the time he's sort of getting to Windsor.
And how do they decide where, because there is talk, isn't there, that they might hold the trial at Windsor But in the end, they decide to hold it in Whitehall. And so what's the thinking about where the location should be for the trial?
Well, I think, you know, the thinking about, so the trial takes place in Westminster Hall, in the Palace of Westminster. And if anybody's been into Westminster Hall, it's a huge space. It's this magnificent medieval hall.
William Rufus.
Yes, yeah. In terms of, you know, the choice of that as a venue, it's a couple of things. One, they want this to be a very public trial. And Harrison actually says to the king, you know, this, I'm sure this wasn't meant to be reassuring, but the king has a conversation with Harrison whilst they're, you know, en route towards Windsor. And Harrison assures him that they're not going to just sort of murder him or kick him down the stairs, but instead that he will be proceeded against in a manner in which the world can witness. And so this is what they want. They want something that's very, very public. And Westminster Hall can accommodate thousands of spectators. The other thing is it's also the site where great state trials have taken place before. So the gunpowder plotters are arraigned in Westminster Hall. It's also the site of key courts, King's Bench, Chancery take place there. So they're trying to say something about this as being kind of a seat of justice as well.
Sorry, are there symbols of royal authority in Westminster Hall?
Well,
be taken down, or
yeah. Well,
you know,
by the time when as they set it up for the trial, and this is one of the other significant things about what else is going on here, and that it's maybe not just a bad king who's being tried, is that you can't see it with my in the way that it's been cropped, my wonderful virtual background here. But when they set the court up, they also put up a new coat of arms, which is what becomes later the coat of arms of the English Commonwealth. So, you know, it's removing the royal coat of arms, and instead we've got these arms of the Commonwealth, of the Cross of St. George and the Irish Harp.
Now, that is the end of today's episode, but tune in tomorrow when we'll have the next instalment. Or, alternatively, you could always join the Rest is History Club at restishistorypod.com and you'll get it straight away. We never miss a promotional opportunity. Anyway, for the time being, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from him.